Be bold. Take risks. Lead by example. Believe in your power. Say what you feel, mean what you say. Hi, I'm Leslie Ann Sion, host of the new podcast series, Sion 180. Join me at Sion 180 on this journey of discovery and advancement.
Searching for that ideal house or rental property with a picture-perfect view of the ocean or lush green hills and breeze that gently caresses your face? Century 21 Grenada helps our clients to go beyond the search to living. At Century 21, our agents understand that a home isn't just walls and a roof, but a sacred, inspiring place where you learn, laugh, play, and create. Contact us today at c21grenada.com or give us a call at 473-440-5227. Go beyond with Century 21.
Hello again, my friends, and welcome to Sion 180, the Caribbean podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Ann Sion. On our podcast series, we feature Caribbean voices from around the world who are making real differences in their spheres of influence. I invite you to check out my website at sion180.com or visit your favorite podcast streaming sites for current episodes as well as past shows. You can also visit my Facebook and Instagram pages for weekly updates, tidbits, advice, and interactions with me, your host, and fellow listeners. We are now into the third season of Sion 180. We have brought you the voices of trauma and triumph, discussing a diverse range of topics, from healthcare to financial matters to leadership and motivation. Today, on our show, we have a very distinguished guest, Mr. Timothy Antwine, Governor of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, a national of Grenada who assumed the duties of the Governor of the Eastern Central Bank since February of 2016. He is a senior economist and development practitioner by training, experience, and passion. He's had a 22-year distinguished career with the government of Grenada, much of which was spent serving with distinction as its permanent secretary in the Ministry of Finance. Governor Antwine has contributed significantly to the development of the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union and the wider Caribbean by serving on several regional and international boards and committees, including as advisor to the Executive Director for Canada, Ireland and the Caribbean in the World Bank Group based in Washington, D.C. At present, he is the chairman of the Eastern Caribbean Home Mortgage Bank and the chairman of the Eastern Caribbean Securities Exchange. I also know him on a personal note to be a motivational speaker and a pastor. I have heard him from the pulpit myself. Governor Antwine, welcome to Sion 180. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sion. Leslie Ann, it's great to connect with you via this forum. Thanks for the invitation and congratulations on your show.
Thank you very much. We are delighted to have you here today. Our topic, which is on Caribbean banking, finance, and the economy, is not too much of a positive one in these gloomy days, but we thought that your input would be of tremendous value to our citizens in the Caribbean and in the diaspora. So, Governor Antwine, I want to begin by saying that your first 6 to 7 years in office has been quite exciting. You've had a number of challenges, natural disasters, hurricanes in Dominica, volcanic eruption in St. Vincent. We've had the pandemic for 2 years. What are your thoughts looking back on your first several years in the office?
Well, there's not been a dull moment. And it's, you know, it's almost 7 years, but it feels like four. Yes. But there's been so much going on. And a lot of it has really been about serving the people of our region, navigating the shocks, and at the same time positioning our currency union for resilience and transformation. Certainly, you know, in my first term, our focus was on really laying out a strategic vision for what we call transforming the ECCU together. And if you look back and we look back, you will see that my tenure has been marked by innovation in a number of areas. And so it is for us a proud moment to recognize the fact that the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank received 5 global awards over the last 5 years. I'm not sure if everybody knows that.
Yes,
yeah,
you have to tout this.
Well, you know, we do the work. We don't do it for reward. We do it for service and for impact. But certainly our work has been recognized globally. And a lot of that is really innovation. So whether it is digital currency, whether it is polymer, whether it is with what we've done with the greening of the campus, whether it's action learning, you know, we have seen and we continue to receive significant plaudits internationally. But we do these things for the people that we serve. That's the motivation. Trying to find a way as a small states to make a difference by coming together and to leverage the example of the central bank, that we have achieved monetary stability by coming together, eight small states, and that we can craft a richness that work for us if we come together to take collective action. And in this period, Ms. Ian, it is so important for us to focus as well on innovation. You know, and we may get into that as we go, but it's been one of the things we also did during this period is return the bank to profitability. When I arrived, you know, we had 3 consecutive years of losses, and we were able to return the bank to profitability and to hit record profits in 2020. Having said that, I must say where we are now is that we are making losses at this moment. We made a loss this year. We probably will make another one next year, and then we will return to profitability. And the reason for that is really what is going on with the Fed, the aggressive interest rate hikes. Our foreign securities are marked to market, fair market treatment. So when interest rates go up, the price of treasuries fall. And so that is what is happening. It's an accounting issue, but I just wanted to make sure people understand what is going on there. But the good news is that while those accounting losses are happening, interest rate, or what we call our investment income, is rising again, because of the other side of the equation. As interest rates rise, they were zero in March. Now today they are 3%, and by the end of this year, they will probably be at 4% or even higher. Next year, probably get to 5%. So we're going to see a recovery in our investment income because of that, but we are dealing with the accounting effects at the moment.
Good. I'm very happy to hear of your successes and your initiatives. I did see the operational green initiative of the bank with its solar technology to reduce its electrical costs, you know, by 60%. So fantastic. You're reducing the carbon footprint. I think of a lot of climate resilience colleagues of ours who would be happy to hear that, Governor.
Indeed. And others are taking our lead and beginning to follow our example.
Exactly.
That's one of the reasons we do it. I mean, it's moral authority. It is demonstration effect. Obviously, lowering carbon emissions and saving some money. The bottom line, last year, we saved over $1.2 million having done that investment.
That's a significant sum.
Yeah, and you see where energy prices are at the moment. So.
Oh, it is crippling. Tell me about it. I looked at my light bill this month and I wanted to choke. So, Governor, you know, we've had a lot of movement in banking in the Caribbean recently with the exit of the Canadian banks. So we are dependent a lot on our indigenous and regional banks. Some may be concerned about the exit of such a mighty power in banking and think that as small indigenous banks, we've now become pawns and very vulnerable to the international financial community. In terms of global trends and standards, are you concerned at all about the resilience, stability, and strength of our banks in the Caribbean? And how are we keeping up?
No, our banks are resilient. The financial system is stable and resilient. And I think we've demonstrated that in this period. You mentioned some of the shocks we've experienced in the last 5 years. Hurricanes, volcanic eruption, pandemic, now inflation. And of course, throughout all of this, our banks have remained solid and they have remained stable. So one of the things that has served us well, or two things with the banks, the fact that they went into the pandemic with strong liquidity and strong capital. And so that has really served us well, because as we explain to people, why do you need capital? Capital is needed to absorb losses, to absorb shocks, and to remain a going concern. It's true for business, it's true for banks. And so our banks have demonstrated, many of them now, of course, are indigenous banks. In fact, 2/3 of the banking assets in our currency union are 8 countries that call ECCB their central bank. We have 2/3 of that assets are now controlled by our indigenous banks. Because as you've seen, as the Canadian banks have sold, they've sold to indigenous banks and of course Republic.
Yes.
But the banks have held their own and are continuing to hold their own. Do I like the fact that the Canadian banks are leaving or have left? No. I would prefer them to have been still here, because you know we would have that diversification. And it will also lessen the pressures or the threat of the risking, that is loss of correspondent banks. But it is. They are now pursuing regions and jurisdictions that offer them higher profits. It's not that they're not profitable in our region. They are. They made profit for many, many years, as they would have left a long time ago.
Yes, but they're looking profits.
But they're looking at risk versus reward. And, you know, you can earn $50 million in the Eastern Caribbean, let's say, as an example. But in another country, you can earn $100 million. What do you think they're going to do? What is that board in Toronto going to do? They're going to opt to move their capital to where they could get the highest return for shareholders. That's pure capitalism. That is, you know, it is what it is. We just have to navigate that development.
So are we keeping up with the global trend in banking in terms of digitalization? I know that as governor, you've been very innovative in that area. And I am seeing a massive decline in cash usage across the globe. I'll give you a quick story. I went to a little cafe in London and I had my little Pong notes. And I said, you know, let me pay for my cappuccino. And they said, I'm sorry, we don't take cash. And I was shocked because I brought cash with me just because of these small items. I didn't want to use my cards. So are we keeping up with the trends in the Eastern Caribbean? Are our folk understanding what is happening now, that they need to get with it?
I think we're making strides. And the pandemic was a blessing in that sense. We were forced to rely on digital tools for work, for worship, for shopping, for school. So in a sense, none of us wanted a pandemic, of course, but what it did was to force our hand on accelerating our digital transformation process. And so yes, if you look in banking, there is a ongoing, unmistakable trend for digitalization, online banking, mobile banking. It's a big cultural shift. And not everybody, of course, has been fully embracing all that. People still want to go into the bank and go into the halls. But the truth is that it is faster and cheaper to go online and also more convenient. You think about the ability to pay a bill online. You think about the ability to check your accounts and move monies among your accounts online without having to go into the bank to make that request and stand in line. Time is money. So we are seeing a definite shift in that direction more and more, and you're going to continue to see that. And in some cases where the banks are not innovating fast enough, you might see them actually partner with fintechs, financial technology companies, to bring the technology to their banks and to their customers, because competition is fierce among our banks. And at the end of the day, it is about the customer and the customer experience. The customer wants lower cost, faster service, safe service always, of course. And so you are seeing that trend, and that trend is irreversible. As a result of that, of course, Leslie, and we have to constantly look at issues like cybersecurity, data protection, and data privacy, because that's the other side of the digital. When you do the enabling, platforms, connectivity, and so on, then you also have to do the safeguards. You have to do the safeguards, cybersecurity, data protection, privacy. You also have to do digital skills or digital literacy, because people have to be able to navigate the digital tools to be able to do their banking, do their payments, do their financial transactions.
That's right.
But the is that you are going to see less and less reliance on physical cash. Because what the public often does not recognize is that cash is expensive. It is convenient to have. People like to have it. They feel empowered to have money in their pocket and pull notes. But the truth is that to prepare it, print it, transport it, store it, secure it, those are costs that the public, the average person does not see, but exist. And ultimately, those costs have to be paid by someone. And it's the same customers who, so when you see fees and charges and you complain, understand behind that you have to pay for these services. These are costs maybe hidden, you don't see them, but they are real and they have to be catered for. So I do not anticipate, and I've been very clear on that, I do not anticipate in the Caribbean a complete elimination of physical cash. Right. I think physical cash will continue to be with us. I think it has its place, if nothing else, as a form of redundancy. But what I do expect is a continual decline in the use of physical cash to some level far lower than where we are now. When I did some research some years ago, and we're going to update that soon, payments, 80% of all our payments at the time were in cash and checks. That's too high. And I give the example that for a small farmer in Grenville or a small farmer in Georgetown, Indiana, or in Marigot in Dominica, they should be able to operate safely at any time of day or night. They ought not to be the target of a robbery because they are collecting and they are storing physical cash.
Yes.
So both the proprietor and the customer, the patron, need to have some sense of safety. And unfortunately, too much physical cash creates its own security challenges. And that is something that people are not seeing. So some people who are fighting it are concerned, well, they force me into plastic, and then if and then they tell you, well, the mark of the beast and all of those things. Those concerns, I mean, I hear, I'm a man of faith, and, I respond to that a certain way. But the truth is that what it also allows, the digital, is for security and for hardening the financial system against crime. And that is very important to safeguard the integrity of our financial system as well.
Yes, because I think a lot of our older members of the public would be concerned about the digitalization. They don't understand computers. They don't understand IT. We're giving them these cards. We're telling them they can't go before their cash teller, do certain services through the ATM machine. It's becoming difficult for that demographic. So your point on digital literacy, while it is extremely important, what do we do with our older folk who have no idea about this technology?
So we do two things. We teach them to use the technology. Many of them can now navigate Zoom. That's how they go into church and prayer meeting. Don't underestimate our older folk or senior citizens. They will come along. And then you make some provision for them in the banking halls. Because the truth is, sometimes it's not just even about their fear of technology. It is for them going to the bank, a community experience, a chance to catch up with someone and to chat and to engage.
Loneliness
is still in some parts of this region. People might not think about it, but loneliness is an issue. We are born to be in community. We're social beings. And so sometimes it is not just about the fact that they don't want to deal with a machine or gadget or whatever. It is also about they want to be able to touch and feel. They want to have a human interaction. So I think the banks still have to give some of that, make some of that available, especially for that group. But I also feel we have to help them, teach them. Their children, their grandchildren can help them, and they ought to do that as well. Because you don't want to leave grandma or grandpa behind.
We can't. We can't afford to do that. They're too valuable to the community, and they've given their service to us already. Governor, I want to address an angst, I think, that most of us in the business communities in the currency union feel, and our Caribbean folks abroad in the diaspora. And that is the difficulties with correspondent banking and wire transfers and our anti-money laundering, our compliance regulations. It has made banking quite onerous. And it's not just onerous for the banks, but it's also onerous for the customers. And so some of us are, quite anxious about whether we are vulnerable to lose correspondent banking privileges within the union. I know that it has been raised at the highest level of the U.S. Congress by the Caribbean Bankers Association. As governor of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank, do you have any concerns about our correspondent banking challenges? And if so, what are these?
I do have some concerns. So that's for the public to be clear. When we speak about correspondent banking, we're speaking about the fact that this is our banks in the Caribbean having accounts with foreign banks to facilitate cross-border payments like wire transfers. If you have a child in the school in the US, you have to pay their school fees. You have to move money from St. Lucia or from Antigua or from Grenada to the US. You need to go through your local bank. Your local bank has to send that money through a foreign bank, i.e. a correspondent bank, before it gets to your child. Or before, if you're in business and you're making a purchase for Christmas, you have to be able to pay your supplier. It requires your bank dealing with a correspondent bank, a foreign bank. So when we speak about correspondent banking, we're speaking about facilitating cross-border payments from country A to country B, without which we cannot effectively engage in the global economy or in the financial system or in the payment system. So that's why correspondent banking relationships are so important. The fact of the matter is, our indigenous banks have been under pressure to maintain these accounts. And some of our smaller indigenous banks did experience a termination of some of these accounts. Their accounts were closed. Why were they closed? They were closed because, as far as the correspondent bank was concerned, a bank in the US or a bank in the UK, all those are correspondent banks, they deemed our banks as too high risk, and that the returns from the relationships were too low. They were not profitable enough. They were not making enough money for the risk that they perceived. And so as a consequence of that, some of our banks 5-6 years ago found themselves losing or having their accounts closed. I do want to report that on account of a very targeted, concerted, sustained advocacy effort on our part, our governments, our leaders, our central bank, and others, we have been able to see some easing of that. So I am not seeing so much of that at the moment, but we remain vigilant because, as I said, many of our banks are now indigenous banks. They control at least 2/3 of all banking assets in our region.
That's correct.
Now, what are the risks that the correspondent banks are concerned about? They're concerned about money laundering. They're concerned that if I'm sending money to my child, on the face of it, that is a legitimate transaction. My child is in school, my child needs funds to study. But where am I getting my money from? Are those funds, the proceeds, a crime? If they are, and I send them through my local bank to the foreign bank, to my child, gets it, that is money laundering, because I've taken illicit money, money from crime, passed it through the system, laundered, cleaned it, and it now looks like legitimate, proper, clean money. So that's a concern, money laundering. There's a concern for terrorist financing. There are concerns about tax evasion. There are concerns about sanctions busting. There are concerns about fraud. So I'm simply, Leslie, pointing out some of the risks that attend correspondent banking, that concern our correspondent banks. And in some cases, they've made determinations in the past, quite arbitrarily and unilaterally, to terminate those relationships because in their mind, those risks were too high for the reward, for the profit they were making. Now, having said that, let me just say, because our indigenous banks are now larger, having purchased some of the Canadian operations, they have become more profitable for our correspondent banks. So that's the good news. So in that sense, some of them are seeing less pressure because they are now more profitable, their accounts, they're doing more business. And so it's risk-reward. They're always making that calculation. And so some of those correspondent banks have said to our indigenous banks, you know, as long as you maintain the relationship around the protocols that we've established, we do not have any imminent desire and to terminate or close your accounts because business is up and so far you're in compliance with the arrangements under the agreement. So that is why correspondent banking, because once you get cut off, then you shut off from the international system.
That's right.
That's why it's too far reaching.
And this is what is infuriating to us in the Caribbean, Governor, because they talk so much about being at risk with the Caribbean banks, etc., anti-money laundering. But we know that there are international banks in the global community that do much more of this and have a higher risk profile. They've been fined millions and millions of dollars for doing exactly what they think is the greatest fair with transactions from the Caribbean. And it's somewhat unfair that because we are small, developing, poor states in large measure, that we face this enormous pressure and threat of a withdrawal of correspondent banking services, because the remittances that come from the diaspora to us in the Caribbean, those are extremely important to us. And losing that facility affects a lot of our communities.
That is correct. And one of the unintended consequences of this threat is how difficult it has become to open a bank account in our region.
Precisely.
I mean, this is a frustration that I share with many people in our region. I talk to people all the time. I talk to the banks as well. And, you know, a lot of what is happening there is really an attempt to comply with these international standards around money laundering, anti-money laundering, and combating terrorist financing. But it's gone to an extreme now where we're hurting peaceful people and their ability to do legitimate business.
Exactly.
So you come out of school, or you are a small business person, you want to start a business, you can't open an account. You know, they want proof of address, they want two IDs, they want this, they want that. Some of these things you simply do not have yet. And here's the irony, which is the point you were making earlier. It is so easy, relatively speaking, to open an account in the United States compared to opening one in the Caribbean.
It is.
And yet, for all you know, that the bulk of the money laundering in the world goes on in the large financial centers, not in these small states.
Absolutely.
And I'm very, very clear. I'm not for a moment suggesting that there's no money laundering in the Caribbean. I am not. I think money laundering goes on everywhere.
Yeah, likewise.
But the point is, in relative terms, these are very small flows compared to anything we see in the advanced economies. Yet they can open accounts with ease, and we can't.
And we can't.
And what that does is that forces people underground. So in a sense, the unintended consequence is the reverse of what you want. You push people underground where they have to move with physical cash and more secrecy, complete anonymity. So I ask the question simply, let me close there. Which one is more suited to fighting money laundering and for financial integrity, physical cash or digital cash? If you think about it, it is digital cash.
Because
physical cash, complete anonymity. Digital cash, managed anonymity. But so that is why we believe, you know, even our central bank digital currency is really an addition, although our motivation is financial inclusion and payment efficiency. But it actually helps to also harden the financial system against crime.
It does indeed. And I'm glad you addressed it in these frank terms. I've been dying to get a perspective on the correspondent banking ailments that one experiences, particularly for those of us in the business community. And it is crippling startups and young entrepreneurs as well, Governor. But I want us to address the gloomy outlook of a global recession that is likely to affect the Caribbean. I see that the IMF is saying globally expect the lowest growth profile since 2001, and that we have to revisit our monetary and our fiscal policies, and we have to be focusing on reducing the cost of living crisis, etc., and dealing with inflation. We're dealing with the geopolitical conflict between Ukraine and Russia. There's instability with China and Iran. There's a fuel crisis. We're still in the hopefully dying stages of the pandemic. What are your thoughts on this imminent global recession? Is it likely to happen, and how will it impact our Caribbean economies?
Yeah, well, you know, Leslianne, it is a real situation, a real concern. I came back from Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago, and it was doom and gloom. I have to be honest about that. Global economy not in a good place, because unfortunately, again, why are we seeing the prospect of a recession? Because of stubbornly high inflation, record inflation, 40-year high in the United States, for example, 8-9%. The central banks around the world, led by the Fed, the Federal Reserve, which is the U.S. central bank, have taken a decision to do anything it takes, whatever it takes, to get inflation under control. And that means raising interest rates. Let's think about it. Inflation is the most pernicious tax on the poor, on the most vulnerable. All of us have effects, but the people who feel it most are the most vulnerable of our society, of our community. And so you have to get inflation under control. Cost of living, people can't eat, the dollar does not go in very far, your household budgets are under enormous strain. Inflation has to be brought under control. But there's a trade-off. To do that, you have to essentially reduce aggregate demand. You have to slow the economy down. You have to cool the economy. That's how the economists would refer to that. And so there is now the real prospect of recession in Europe, certainly in the UK and in all probability Europe next year. The US, possible. Interesting enough, the data that came out from the US this week suggests that the US economy is still relatively strong. Yes. And although it is slowing, it is not slowing as fast as some may have feared.
Predicted.
Or thought.
Yes.
Predicted, yeah. Correct. But there is still a likelihood. I mean, I think there's a 50-50 chance now that there will be a recession in the United States in 2023. And that has implications for us because, of course, we rely on the U.S. for, you mentioned it earlier, remittances, tourism, foreign direct investment, among other things. And typically, when there is a recession in the our major trading partners like the United States and UK and so on, there is a lag, 12, 18 months. We are not projecting a recession in the Caribbean, certainly in the Eastern Caribbean, the currency union. We are not projecting a recession next year. But certainly, no, we are not. We expect the economies will grow, continue to rebound from COVID, from the pandemic. But certainly, a slowing down in the global economy will ultimately have an effect, albeit with a lag, in our region. And then, as you mentioned, the geopolitical issues. What is going to happen with that war in Ukraine? When will it end? Where will oil prices be? We are oil importers, most of us. Those have implications. You can't predict the price of oil because it's driven by geopolitics. You know, so those are things that, and of course, we talk about food and fuel, but there's also fertilizer. The cost of that has gone up dramatically as well. Yes. As a result. Of course, there were pressures, and I keep clarifying that, you know, I'm not blaming everything on the war. The fact of the matter is, after the pandemic, or when we started to reopen, the pandemic is still going on, but hopefully at the back end, we saw a surge in demand. And supply chains were not able to respond to that. And so inflation rose. That's a fact.
Yes.
But even as the supply chains recovered and were starting to recover and so on, shipping was starting to get better. You remember the days when you were ordering things on Amazon and what could take a week was now taking 3 weeks, so it wasn't available.
That's right.
Supply chain issues. Yes. Those things were easing, but then the war came. And the war exacerbated all of that because it made a lot of things scarce. We've seen now the weaponization of oil and gas and even food in this period, which when that happens, it drives up the price of these things. And we import so much of what we consume in this region that we are importing inflation every single which way you look.
That is so correct. And Governor, I wish we had more time. Our 30 minutes is already racing. But I wanted to end off by asking you, in the face of these volatile times and uncertainty and the rising cost of living, what kind of recommendation or advice can an economist, a banker, a regulator like yourself offer to the ordinary working man in the community and to the businessman who is trying to keep his business afloat and expand? What do we do? Do we save? Do we invest? Do we hold back? What are our best preparatory methods that we can use in the face of this?
Well, I'll start with something that's purely non-financial. It's all in the mind. We have to adopt a growth mindset. A growth mindset simply reframes problems as opportunities. So in this period, whether you are an individual or your business or government, you have to seize these challenges to create change, transformation. Our backs are against the wall, what do we do with food? If we have to depend so much on food, is this now the time for us to get serious about producing more of our food? Now, there are a number of things we have to do where that is concerned. If you're in business, now is the time for you to consider a shift to more digital platforms where you can, both to cut costs, but also to make more of your business available at home and abroad. You know, push that. So it's forcing you because, you know, the pandemic forced us, but then what did we do differently during the pandemic? What did we learn? What did we do differently? What do we gain? And I'm not talking about weight now. I'm talking yes. about creating from the skills.
Yes.
What did we gain? All right. Savings. It is always sensible to have something set aside for the rainy day. That is basic resilient financial resilience because the shocks keep coming. So yes. you can't spend all over. So you need to be prudent with your money. You can't spend everything you earn. It is not how much you earn that matters, it's how much you keep. You have to set aside. Investing, there are opportunities. Of course, you have to be thoughtful and careful, but there are opportunities as well in this crisis, in this challenging moment for people. At the level of individuals, we have to look at tastes and preferences. Is this now not the time for us to look at our food basket again and make some switches, make a few adjustments, if you will, in what we consume? Less of the ultra processed foods, more of our local foods. And by the way, and this might sound facetious and maybe some people might even find it objectionable, but some intermittent fasting is not a bad idea, both in spiritual terms and in physical wellness terms.
Yeah, I practice it myself.
There you go. So why? You know, well, we have to say that because some may say, oh, they say that, but they're eating. Well, we eat sometimes, but we fast sometimes. The point is, this is an opportunity to make some adjustment in our lives for the better. And certainly on electricity, you have to conserve. Fuel, you have to conserve. The costs are high, we import these things. You can't substitute that at the moment until our renewables are further along. So you can't just be driving up and down, you know, liming aimlessly and so on and spending money and fuel. At home, you have to look at, so make those adjustments, you know. And I will always say, as a man of faith, draw on our faith, because certainly for me at a personal level, that is a core part of my resilience. In fact, it starts there for me.
Yes, yes.
And so as people of faith in this moment, we must also draw on our faith, as we have done in the past, through the difficult seasons of life and through the challenges and the storms. Those things, our faith, has undergirded us and helped keep us going. And that is not something we should see us not. So it may not sound as economics and finances, but to be honest with you, it is as fundamental and as basic as that. So these are just some suggestions. If we had more time, we could explore more of those issues.
Yes, but we get the message, Governor. There are some lifestyle changes and some adjustments to be made. They're easy for us to adopt. We just have to have the mindset to get it done. I want to thank you so much for your contribution to the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union, and for what you do for our small developing states. Certainly, as a Grenadian, we are thrilled to have you back just for the few days in the Spice Isle. And Governor, continue to do the good work. We're very proud of you, and God bless you.
Thank you, Leslie, and blessings to you and all our viewers, listeners. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I want to sincerely thank Governor Timothy Antwine for his valuable insight and information that he imparted to us this morning on Caribbean banking, finance, and our economies. It certainly has been reassuring to hear him today and recognize that we are indeed still resilient and strong within the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union. Thank you for listening. Be safe, everybody.